Welcome to another episode of Bullproof. Today's episode is different. We're not talking about investigations. We're talking about the mental side of people losing them. What happens after the sirens stop? We're going to find out today. Before we do, I want to thank all our guests, first of all, for listening, and all our listeners for making Apple Podcasts Bulletproof a top 10 podcast. And it's not because of people like myself or my voice. It's because of these amazing guests I have. And we have yet another amazing guest today. How are you doing today? Thanks so much for coming on.
You're welcome. It's certainly my pleasure. I'm doing well.
Great, great. So where is home for you?
Well, currently I live just outside of Chicago, Illinois. And I've been here for a really long time, so I'm pretty well know the Chicago landscape. And
All right, awesome. Has the weather warmed up yet? Because it's still cold here in New Jersey, I'll tell you that.
It is probably in the 40s, and we're in the middle of a huge cold front with a lot of wind. We live at the end of Tornado Alley, so we've already had, over 50 documented tornadoes this spring. So
that's crazy.
Yeah, so we're worried about that, but it's cold. It's damp.
It's a crazy, yes, but a crazy winter, and it's still not warm here either. I mean, it's still like just trying to get to 50. You know what I mean? Let's get into a couple things today. Let's get kind of dive right into it. What I wanted to ask you was, and I have a whole bunch of set questions that I've been dying to ask, because, I was a police officer for about 7 years in the NYPD. But again, obviously, we respond to, right? We respond to a job, whether it's an EDP, whether it's, somebody's hurt, somebody got robbed, somebody got mugged, God forbid. So for you, my question is, what do first responders see that civilians would never understand? What would you say that would be in your opinion?
I really love that question. And I'm going to answer kind of in a circumvent. So
sure.
Kind of narrative here. I've been a critical incident stress team responder since right after Katrina. And so I was always there in the aftermath of it, and, talking about that process. And I became super interested in wanting to understand more. And at the time, some years later, I started teaching graduate level psychology, and I invited a colleague of mine to teach police psychology with me. And so throughout, 10 years, I taught with maybe six different police officers police psychology, and every single one of them was so different. And a colleague of mine who's a negotiator said, I had asked him if I could come watch one of the tactical plays as a role player. And, he set me up for that. And so for about 10, 15 years, I took students to tactical role plays so that they got an understanding of both sides. One, to know what it might feel like a little bit if you happen to be in a situation with an active shooter or a barricade or whatever, all of those different drills that tactical team and police officers run. And then one of the officers, Kent Williams, who does a really brilliant presentation called Breach Point, was hired as chief of Bartlett, Illinois. And he had three goals. And that was to take care of people's physical health, their spiritual health, and their psychological health. And, we joke that I had an 8-year job interview with him. But since 2011, I've worked as an embedded police psychologist for the Bartlett, Illinois Police Department. And I went in thinking that I would be talking about things like we talk about in critical incident stress debriefing. And, being on scene and then being with them afterwards, it was so much broader than I could have imagined. And the depth of not only vicarious trauma that they're exposed to, but the amount of grief that police officers experience
Well, let me ask you,
is huge.
Cabby. Let me ask you a question, piggybacking on what you just said. What is, would you say? And again, obviously, I have my opinion. I was only a police officer 7 years, so again, I
That's a
can't
long
say.
time, though.
And but I'm saying, I have my own opinions. I'm not this grizzled 30-year veteran. But I come from a family of police officers. My brother was a police officer. My father was a sergeant. Everybody, uncles, cousins. So, what would you say is the most common psychological issue in cops? Is it that they can't? I always had, and again, I'm just going to piggyback on what I just asked. I was always lucky or blessed in a situation where I could see the most, excuse my language, fucked up things, like somebody blow their head or whatever. And you're going to find this interesting, right? And I'm going to take it back one step. So when we used to go to these crime scenes, like these oh my, horrifying crime scenes, we all used to joke. In a sense, we're not joke
Yeah, I
in
know.
a demeaning
Yeah.
way, but joke like, oh, one shouldn't lose his head, or the guy has a headache, whatever we'd say.
Right.
But I think that was our psychological mechanism
Absolutely.
to deal with what is in front of us, because it's not something,
Right.
when you see, again, not to be graphic,
Right.
brains scattered all over the wall and the
Right.
guy's half his face is shot off. I always thought, like, people sometimes, if looking from an outside in, think, oh, cops are cold. But
No.
it's not that we're cold at all. It's just that I think, due to the circumstance of what you're dealing with, I
Right.
think that was a defense mechanism we would use. But once I got home to the precinct and took my stuff off, my uniform,
Right.
I was done. You know what I mean? I
Right.
was, everything I saw, whatever, I was lucky enough to compartmentalize and throw away. Whereas
Right.
some cops, I used to call them 4 to 4s, right? So they would work a 4 to 4, meaning 4 p.m., and they all be at the bar till 4 a.m. and then
Yeah.
wake up and go back to the job again, and that became their
Right.
life.
Absolutely.
So that's what, when I say psychological, I just think probably most cops that have these issues are ones that can't compartmentalize what it is they're dealing with on a day-to-day.
I think that I would add to that, and for those officers who compartmentalize at some point or another, for many of them, the compartment gets really full, and it spills into your private life. I remember having a conversation at the dinner table with my husband, who is a heavy duty mechanic, and our daughter, who was high school, maybe. And I remember sitting there one night and listening to them. And they were telling me about their days, like every detail of their day, like the conversation that you hope people are having with their families, right? Because you're sitting there and you're making family time and you're hearing about their day. I couldn't talk about anything that I had seen or I had experienced, partly because we had an agreement that there were some things that we didn't, my husband and I, we didn't want in this house, and that we didn't necessarily want to expose our daughter to. And so I sat there, just talking superficially, and it really, I mean, like it really hit me at that time, how many of my officers, where did they go and talk about what they had experienced, because I was still working actively as a therapist, and my clinical specialty is trauma and self-injury and complex symptom management. And I never wanted to talk about that at home, but now I couldn't even talk about the stuff that I truly, truly was enjoying doing, working with police. And so I had luckily some great guidance. I my friend, the negotiator, you want a great interview. You should maybe want to reach out to him. His name is Scott Tillema. He is a negotiator and he keynote speaker, but when he was still working as a cop and he was in and out of, he was in grad school, we would have these sort of conversations, or I would talk with my colleagues from the critical incident team. And what I discovered was, number one, your humor, it humor is the highest level of psychological protective defense.
Yeah, exactly.
And it
Exactly.
reflects also your intelligence when, you know, your depth of emotional intelligence. And I think it was Scott who once told me there's no way on earth that I could ever have my true reactions in the situation because then I couldn't do my job. And so, you know, that led to a great number of conversations about, like, so you go to your job and you perform your role and you perform your duty, but your body is still mammalian and it is still taking in information. And, you know, most of the information that you take in is through your senses, which is nonverbal. And
Right.
so
Oh.
that is often where when people start to become, you know, cynical or sort of on that, we talk about this at the retreat, the spectrum of being kind of having a stimulus, which organizes you, part of that OODA loop, right? But when you get through the OODA loop, at some point it's supposed to be cognitive. Well, isn't it interesting? Almost all of your training trains you to muscle memory where it's not cognitive. It's muscle memory. And so you walk onto a scene and you've had repeated exposure to all of this horror. The incident is already over. There was nothing you could have done to prevent it, to protect the person. And so now your next thing is to move forward to get justice for them, right? So you're on task. That's all cognitive, but your body is still picking up all of those millions of generations of instincts to run, fight, flee, freeze.
Well, again, it's amazing. And for everybody just joining us right now, we're on with police psychologist Cami Juswin. Would you say, from your experience, Cami, does someone ever get to the point, from what you've seen, police officers or what have you, do they get to the point of just there's no return? You can't come back from wherever you are psychologically? Have you seen that happen?
That's such a great question, and I'm
I'm full
going
of them,
to,
Cammy. I'm full
yeah,
of them. I told you,
great,
offline. I
you
told
got
you
my
I had a
number.
whole
Call
bunch of
me
questions for
anytime.
you.
I am going to say absolutely not, and
Okay.
actually, I truly believe that. And you know, for about the first 20, well, what's cool about being a psychologist is very few of us ever work just one job at a time. So we, you know, we have lots of different things that we do. So I've been fortunate to be a hospital clinician, an academic, and doing police psychology work. But what I learned early on from the complex trauma clients that I saw who, like, literally were born into a world of being abused and, you know, neglected, all of those things. I think that one of the things that when someone psychologically, cognitively commits to moving forward in their life using the past as a point of reference, that they've already survived.
Okay.
And that what we're doing at this point is creating meaning and creating purpose for your life today. And so, you know, I've walked with hundreds of complex clients who are chronically suicidal. Like, I mean, can you, when you talk about sort of being at the very end, I equate that to so many of my clients who've said to me, the only thing in my life that I can control is how I die. And so it often reflects this sense of deep despair over what they see as randomness in the world. And,
Is
you
that
know,
why, well, again, and to segue to that, because again, another question I wanted to ask you. Do you think that's a real, well, not, it's not really, but it kind of piggybacks off what you're saying. Would you say that's why a lot of relationships and marriages and with significant others fail? With cops and even maybe firemen or what have you, but do you think that's a big reason?
Yeah, I have to say, very, very likely. I think that part of it is also the industry, in that you take an oath to take care of the planet, basically, right? And that you're going to do good in all places and uphold the Constitution, et cetera, and so on. And you willingly choose to go where you pray that nobody on your street ever has to go to or ever has to experience, right? And so, like, think about when was the last time that you felt really comfortable at your neighborhood barbecue picnic, you know, your neighborhood, if you guys like my neighborhood. I always tell this infamous story about going to the neighborhood barbecue, and like I'm diagnosing them. And I don't do that for a living. Like, if I know you, I'm just Cammie. If I don't know you, I'm doing all of my, you know, are you organized, not organized? Are you intentional? Are you, you know, like, and then I start the psych stuff, you know, and it's like, what are your motives of your misbehavior? And it's like running through. And, you know, I look at some of these people like, I'm so glad. I pray that you never have to know what I know in my head.
Well,
So when I start working with people, very often the one of the things that, you know, we'll talk about is this separation of, especially if you have a calling, you know, that calling you've been answering your whole life. The uniform sanctions you at a bigger level,
right.
but it's so important to go to work and do your calling and then come home and live in that life at home with a different face of that calling. So that means
Yeah.
being really invested in, I went to work and for whatever my shift was, I took care of my community and then I put it in the hands of the next shift. I need to go home and live the results of people contributing to my ability to live a good life, a happy life, to be connected. Because if I'm not connected at home, what am I really trying to protect over here?
Right.
And so it's like, you know, I need to have my family be a place and my friends and my home be a place where I get nourishment, where I am integrated into the fabric, because over time, that department is going to stand even after I no longer wear their uniform. And I better still have a life. It's kind of like, what is that fable, the grasshopper and the ant? Like, you can't live your life like a grasshopper and then expect to come home and not have sowed any investment or had any interaction with them. It's the ant. You have to work in all of the places.
But
If you have a chance ever to talk to Mark Junkerman, Marc Junkerman, he is out of Baltimore. He's a retired police officer out of Baltimore, former military, lives over somewhere in Maryland. And he comes to our retreat in Chicago and he talks about he this is one this I wish I could just encapsulate it very concisely. But what he talks about is that we have to live simultaneously in a lot of different areas in our lives, you know, personal life, our relational life, our financial life, our job, fitness, faith, you know, this whole row. And that if you put it like on a steering wheel of a ship, you know, if I'm focused on my job, none of these are going to get the attention of that I need. So at times I need to change my bearings, and when I go home, that's what I need to steer towards and be involved in and invested in, because my calling is to be connected to my family.
Right. No, again, yeah, I mean, that's what he's saying is absolutely correct. But again, he's, you know, I've heard that numerous times. That's not a fortunately, I mean, very wise words, but you know, there's a book called CEO of Your Life, and basically it breaks it down to, like you said, work, finance, family, faith, but, you know, all this stuff. So very, very, very wise words, but and very true, and very, very true. So yeah, I'd love to talk to him. We'll see, maybe, you
He's
know.
a he and he all three of the people I've mentioned are very dynamic and really wise. What I like about, especially when Mark comes to talk at the retreat, is
Well, let's talk
that,
about you, Gabby. We'll talk about Mark another day. I'll talk about Mark when I speak to Mark. I'm happy to have you right now. I
yeah,
don't want,
that's
you know,
fine.
and I'm sure Mark would appreciate you promoting Mark. But like I said, I don't want to take the time away from you to put to give Mark his flowers. But yes, I will reach out to you offline, and maybe we'll get, if you could connect us, it would be great. But here's a, you know, my next question is. And again, these are all questions that, because I've grown up, again, I was a oops baby, right? So my father was like 44 when I was born back in the 70s, right? So obviously, my brother and sister are 11, 10 years older than me. So, and again, my father was old school. I mean, old school. He's born in the, you know, 1927. So, you know, but never wanted to show his emotions really. Never really talked about work. No matter what happened, you never knew. And you know, my brother, obviously, you know, they got on, my brother got on in the mid-80s. I got on in the mid-90s. But in his, my, well, forget my father's. That's that what I'm going to say is faded, you know, we already know this. In the 80s and 90s too. I feel like nowadays it's a lot easier to put a plea for help out there than it was, you know, when I got on, because that's not something you did, because that would just show a sign of weakness, and not weakness, but it's not something you
It,
shared
and
with your, you know, associates type of thing.
you're absolutely right. And I do think that that is an incredible generational kind of attitude. And I see it also in hospital settings. It's like, if if you talk about, like, I am really struggling,
Right.
people very often are almost like it's this contagion. If you're struggling, and I don't want to be with you because, number one, I don't know if I can count on you because your head's not in the right space. But then, number two, if that could happen to you, it could probably happen to me. So I'm just going to avoid you. And I've
Yes.
seen
Yeah.
that over and over and over.
Right.
And to the other extreme, now I'm seeing where some of the newer generation, you know, well, the department makes me mad, and so this is a toxic environment. And my
Right.
comment to that is, of course, it's a toxic environment. You know, every environment that you go to is going to have toxicity in it when you have hierarchy, power, and obligations at different levels. And then you have people who are trying to do jobs that are often conflicting, right? And then you
Sure.
do have sometimes toxic people, but you have to step back and say, what is in my sphere of control? And you have to own it and not expect that the organization necessarily is going to accommodate you, and it's not the organization's job to make you happy. And
Right, but do you?
that's part of the new coming in.
Well, you know what though? And you're gonna think this is an odd comment because but as somebody who came, like again, I'm not old in any which way, shape, or form. I'm in my early 50s, but I do think, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, Cammy, I do think that's now overused. In a sense, where that's a perfect, if I do something fucked up,
Yeah.
right? And excuse my language, but
That's all right.
it's a perfect crutch to say, well, you know what? I did that because I haven't been feeling myself, blah, 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 or
Yeah.
blah, 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 blah. I need help. It's all, again, I'm not, listen,
No,
whoever needs help
I
needs
do
help.
think that we're in some cases, and then having to have that conversation with people about, yes, your supervisor gave you this task because you're working, let's just say, for example, you're a patrol officer. That's a
Right.
reasonable task to ask.
Right.
And
No, absolutely. But I just think that
yeah.
it's gone from one extreme, where you would never admit a thing,
Yeah.
to when something goes, shit hits the fan, that's a good go-to.
Right.
Well, I haven't been feeling myself, or
Right.
I have something going on. What have you? I was just curious that, and you already answered, but like I said, I think sometimes that's used now, overused and taken advantage of.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm very fortunate in my department that, and I tell them all the time, I am available 24/7, and I know that, you may be working overnight. I'll come hop in the squad car and ride with you and we can talk, or you can talk in my office.
Right.
And about whatever is going on. And a number of our young officers I'm seeing, not just in my department, but this is something that I talk about when I teach at the police academy, is maybe even have someone out there that you have a working relationship with who understands the culture that you work in, and that you go and you do a head check pretty regularly and just talk about stuff, and then about how to manage what your intentions are as a police officer, so that when you go to your job with your intentions set of being the best police officer, the best patrol officer, whatever level that you're at, how do you handle the stress? How do you recognize what is truly, for example, toxic
Right.
versus a reasonable request or order or situation that, as it's set up, that this is the way that this chief wants to run their department, and then this commander and this sergeant want to run their whatever, and that's not necessarily toxic. But just because I'm unhappy with it, that doesn't mean it's necessarily toxic. It means I need to do some shifting or adapting to stay ahead, to stay on my feet. And
Well,
they and actually, I just read a really cool research article, and what they were talking about was people who cognitively can reappraise what they are facing, which goes back to your initial question about how you compartmentalize and then you use humor. That's cognitive reappraisal. You know that it's serious, and then to manage it, you use humor to dispel the tension. But
right.
you are taking it to a, I have a job to do, versus those people who avoid the emotion. People who avoid acknowledging their personal experiences and then fail to cognitively reappraise it, those are the individuals who struggle so much with anxiety, depression, and post-traumatic stress. So, to your second question, when I'm working with people in that group, anxious, depressed, some level of PTSI, post-traumatic stress injury, that it's let's sit down and talk about what you've already survived. And if you're going to stay in this field, what changes might you need to make internally? using those different categories of your life so that you can see that you there is hope, there is a place that you can move, there is a place that you can grow. But the fact of the matter is that it's like working on an oncology unit and then spending your whole life being surprised that there are people with cancer. You have to figure out how to survive that in order to live your calling. And maybe your calling isn't in this setting, maybe your calling is somewhere else, but you can't keep getting mad at the environment because the ocean will always be the ocean.
Well, again, for everybody listening, we're talking to Cami Jaswin. Am I saying that right, Cami? Perfect. I'm pretty decent with pronunciation. I just wanted to make sure. At the end of the show, Cami, when we come to the end, we usually do a what I call a spitfire round. So I'm going to ask you 10 questions, and you just tell me the first thing that comes to your mind.
All right.
Not overthinking it, not explaining it, just the first thing. And I don't have to explain to a psychiatrist what I mean by first thing. So, are
Let's
you ready
hope.
for that?
Well, I hope so.
Oh, no, there's nothing too crazy. All right, ready? So, most understood thing about trauma.
That you can be functional, although many people are
Okay,
very
now you're
troubled.
now you're
Yeah,
giving
I'm
me a
just saying
whole
are
now you're
very
giving me
troubled, are very they're grieving. And they're grieving and they don't understand the grief.
Okay. One trait every good cop has.
Steadfastness.
Steadfastness. Okay. Biggest mental weakness you see.
Gosh, biggest mental weakness. Not having too much ego.
Okay. Can someone fake being mentally strong?
Yes.
What
Not for
breaks
long.
people?
Not for long.
Okay. What breaks people faster? Fear or stress?
Fear.
One thing civilians should never say to a cop.
You should have done it this way.
Okay, very good. Are most people mentally tougher or weaker than they think?
Weaker.
Burnout is avoidable or inevitable?
Yes. I think it depends on your mindset and how you're living your life. But
Okay.
I think if you're working high function, high stress, high exposure job, I think that it's more than likely inevitable.
Okay.
But it's manageable.
What's more dangerous, overconfidence or hesitation?
Oh. There's this part of me that says, well, if you're a tactical guy, if you're this, is that. I say that one more time. I want to make sure I get the word right.
What's more dangerous, overconfidence or hesitation?
Overconfidence, I think.
Okay. One mindset shift that makes someone stronger instantly.
I can figure this out.
Very good. That wasn't too bad. It wasn't too painful, was it?
No, it's just it's funny because it makes me reflect like how far I've grown in understanding the different groups of officers and their different like paths of what they pursue. So, because you're
Okay.
tactical officers, your patrol, your investigators, they're sometimes very, very different. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, I mean, Cami, that went by quick. Again, is there a place if someone's listening or would like to reach out to you that they can? Do you have any social media handles or any
I do. I do. I have my LinkedIn page, and on my LinkedIn page, and it's just Cami Jeswin, I always post the most recent flyer for our grant. It's a grant-funded 4-day retreat here in Chicago. Everything is paid for: the room, parking, meals, the program, and it's 4 days of intensive and immersive, very personal peer support for suicide awareness, suicide prevention, mental health, stress management. I'm just going to brag. I have the best people in the area who give their time, energy to it as peers. We're in our fourth year, going on our fifth year. We've served over 300 people in our small group events, yeah, you'll always find the flyer there. I do have a Facebook page, Intensive Recovery Retreats. It's associated with the Haymarket Center of Chicago. So those are probably the best ways to get a hold of
Great.
me.
Awesome. Great.
I'm out there.
Awesome.
So
Amazing. Amazing. Well, listen, very interesting today, a very interesting take,
thank you.
with again, a guest that, I don't usually have, but is fits right in the vein of Bulletproof. And, I'd like to thank you so much for coming on. Once again, we have police psychologist Cami Jewsman. I'd like to thank my listeners. I'd like to thank you all for making us a top 10 podcast. But if we're at 10, that means we can go 10 more spots. So again, as always, stay bulletproof. Cami, such a pleasure.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on, and we will be airing this very soon. I'm excited to share it. Thank you so much.
Me too. Thank you so very much.
Well,
So,
my pleasure.
yeah.